what did happen? Okay. See, we did crash. It was on this crazy island. And we waited for rescue, and there wasn't a rescue. And then there was a smoke monster. And then there were other people on the island. We called them the Others. And they started attacking us. And we found some hatches, and there was a button you had to push every 180 minutes, or... Well, I was never really clear on that. But the Others didn't have anything to do with the hatches. That was the Darmanish. They were all dead. The Others killed them. And now they're trying to kill us. And then we teamed up with the Others because some worse people were coming on a freighter. Desmond's girlfriend's father sent them to kill us. So we stole their helicopter, and we flew it to their freighter, but it blew up. And we couldn't go back to the island because it disappeared. So then we crashed in the ocean, and we floated there for a while until a boat came and picked us up. And by then, there were six of us. That part was true.
I came on a plane.
What plane?
A Jira Flight 316. And that's how I returned to the island.
So, why him?
What was it that was so wrong with me? What about me?
What about you?
Hello and welcome to The Storm, a Lost Rewatch podcast for Season 6, Episode 13, The Last Recruit. And the time has come, finally, in Season 6, to ask our hosts, what's your sideways job? My name's Dave Gonzalez, and I've searched my heart, and I'm just some sort of useless lawyer. I'm not that interesting.
My name is Joanna Robinson. I thought I'd land myself the cushiest gig, so I've decided to be Mr. Hugo Reyes' personal assistant, and he treats me very well.
And I'm Neil Miller, and I think I actually have the cushiest gig because I am the health and PE teacher for whom Mr. Locke is substituting. And let me tell you a secret. I'm not sick. I'm just hanging out at home. Which makes me feel responsible for him getting hit by a car. Desmond's fault.
Don't let Desmond make you feel responsible for that. That's a little too much to take on yourself. If this is your first time joining us, welcome. This podcast is an ideal companion if you're rewatching the ABC series Lost with Us or Flashing Sideways and visiting the Cork Island for the very first time. That's because each episode comes in sections for your listening pleasure. There's first a calm section that only discusses the preceding episodes and avoids all spoilers. Then there's a second section we call The Storm because it's a storm of spoilers. Discussing this week's episode in the context of the entire series and over a decade of Lost fandom. If you look down at your podcasting device, you have time codes. Something fun I discovered this week while we were listening to some old episodes. Depending on what service we were at when we put those time cones, they're just going to be rough estimates. Thanks to weird shifting ad times and pre-rolls. So, luckily, at the beginning of The Storm, if you've never done it before, there's a long sound cue of Mr. Clickety-Clack, Smoke Monster Lock himself, warning you to stay out of the storm. So skip around, you should be fine. Feel free to use the time codes. For the final season of Lost, we've shifted the releasing of the podcast on Saturday evenings in the U.S. after our group live watch in our Storm Slack. How do you join those live watches? Why, you go to patreon.com/stormspoilers. There you will find a way to subscribe to us for a monthly fee, and depending on what level you choose, you get more and more bonus content. Any level gets you access to the Storm Slack for the watch-alongs. And when you subscribe for the very first time, you get instant access to our previous years of bonus content, which include extra interviews, bits, bonus podcasts, and various oddities. Joanna, there's so much bonus content.
So much. Pew-pew! Listen, we do a lot of stuff over here. If you're just joining us here at the end, let me tell you some things that we do. There are live watches. There are bonus episodes of podcasts. I do feels like the first time with our pal Grissom Russo from the Buffering podcast. Sometimes I do these things called Chen Pop or Gen Pop with David Chen. There was one last week. All sorts of stuff going on. As soon as we finish recording this, Chris and I are about to hop over and watch Gone in 60 Seconds for Angelina July, the end of Angelina July.
Hell yeah.
For the Feels Like the First Time crew. So all of that's happening. You can go to stormpodcast.com to see what we're up to. You can follow us on Twitter @stormpodcast. That is a nice way to interact with us. Also, we love it when you leave us reviews. Guys, we got 6 reviews this week.
Oh.
Wow.
Which is so many reviews. So I don't know what, I don't even know where to start. I'll start with this one. AMM Mac from Australia says, 5 stars, just discovered this gym. All right. I was at the end of my season 5 rewatch of Lost when I found this amazing podcast. Excellent analysis, fantastic interviews, and charming hosts. I'm sorry I poorly timed my rewatch. Did not get the chance to do the journey together. Could not rate this podcast any higher. Absolutely love it. So thank you. And I don't know what else to read. They're all really nice. I'll read this one. This is from Shreya, of course. Lovely Shreya. wrote, great podcast, great banter, great analysis, 5 stars. This is one of my all-time favorite podcasts, and this review is long overdue. I started listening to Neil, Joanna, and Dave while covering Game of Thrones. Their podcast is so fun and insightful and entertaining that when they released their final episode on Game of Thrones season 8, I wanted to save it for entertainment during my next long flight. There was a global pandemic and I didn't travel. 1 year later, I finally listened to the podcast episode I had saved for over a year on my flight home from LA. It was everything I wanted and more. It made me laugh. It made me tear up remembering Jamie, Knight, Brienne, and it made me forget I was in a flying metal tube. Their podcast is so great that it made me start Lost. I'm not big into television. I listen to most of my podcasts on 1.5 speed, but I slow this one down so that it will last longer. I encourage everyone to scroll through their feed and find something you're interested in. They've done Star Wars, some Marvel movies, and more. You'll be instantly hooked and maybe even dive into watching a 17-year-old network television show just so you can hear more of their great analysis. Thank you, Shreya. So thank you all for your reviews. They're all very kind. I really appreciate it. And then we got a couple emails. Most of the emails I'm reading this week are spoilery Storm emails. But I have just a couple that I want to get into before we dive into everything. This is a quick one from Jeremy, who says, could Hurley lift Mjolnir?
Definitely.
Dave?
Right? Because it's just about being worthy. It's worthy. Not about strength.
Yeah, worthy. Dave?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Hurley could lift Mjolnir.
Okay.
The more important question is Hurley the only character on Lost?
That was the next question. Is there anyone else who could lift Mjolnir?
Penny, maybe. On Christmas.
On Christmas only.
Only on Christmas.
She's a Christmas Thor.
Okay. So please email us, hostthestormpodcast.com, if you have any idea of who else might be able to lift Mjolnir. Jeremy suggested maybe Jack when all is said and done, after we see where this character is arcing.
Oh my God. So many people who have never seen all of Lost who are not big Jack fans just rolled their eyes all the way around.
And then Jeremy also said Terry O'Quinn should play Professor X in the MCU. Bald, wise, and wheelchair acting experience. Maybe mm-hmm. Alan Dale is Magneto. So thanks, Jeremy. Great email. And then I also want to read this email that we got that my co-hosts have already heard because I sent it over because it was so nice. But it is from Rachel. I'm not going to read the whole thing, but I want to read some praise for our pal, Neil Miller. So Rachel says, it's 2021. Do we know how our hosts are doing? And Rachel wrote this in reaction to something that Neil put on Twitter, which we don't need to get into, but she says, first, we don't need to know what Neil was responding to in his Twitter. He is allowed to have trauma respond to it, not have to explain what trauma is. But Neil, I need you to know that your work has a great deal of value, especially for me personally. In 2019, I made a career change that turned into 124 days of absolute horror for me and my family. I could not make the career transition. The workplace was toxic. I cried myself to sleep, cried in the car on my lunch hour, cried in my therapist's office once a week, and basically drove my family crazy while I waited for my next move. I medicated the crap out of myself, hoping I could erase the memory of working there every day. As an Arrested Development fan, I wanted to find some forget-me-nows. While trying desperately to distract myself, my husband and I started a Lost rewatch and a Game of Thrones rewatch. Every day, my dutiful husband watched between 4 to 6 episodes with me from the time I got home from work until I went to sleep at night. In furtherance of my hope to distract myself, I stumbled upon the Storm and Lost Rewatch podcast. By that time, I want to say you were on the Glass Ballerina, but as I previously mentioned, I was on a shit ton of Klonopin, so I could be wrong about that. At a time when I seriously felt like my life was falling apart around me, your podcast really helped me. I committed myself to listening to it got hooked up with your Patreon subscribers to have a community rather than full-on isolate myself, and I really started to feel better. After 124 days, I was able to transition to a better career for me, and at the risk of putting too much pressure on you, Neil, your work did that. Your impact is much further reaching than you think it is. Please don't fall down. You're here for a reason. Your work is valuable. You are valuable. Positive vibes, Rachel. So I just want you, Neil, we love you. That's all.
Very, very lovely. Thank you.
Good point. Right, Dave? We love Neil.
Yeah. I don't know why there was any other doubt of that, how much I love Neil. Okay, here we go. I want everybody to say the word smooth, and you're going to hear how Neil is the best mixed on this podcast every week. Here we go. Smooth. Joanna.
Smooth. Did I jump in? Sorry.
Yeah, that's fine. Dick move. We're going to get a double dipping of smooth from Neil. Joanna?
Smooth.
And Neil.
Yeah, smooth.
Oh, yeah. Oh,
I God. Know. He's got the best voice for radio. It's true. All right.
Since Rachel wrote us a really lovely email, I'm not going to make any self-deprecating jokes about having a good voice and or face for radio.
No, that's not what I didn't say. Face for radio. Anyway, all right. Yeah, listen, if you want to spend more time with any of us, including myself, please do join us for the live watches. We only have a few left. There's like, what, 4 more to go after this? Of Lost. I will be hosting the next one, which is The Candidate. That will be me. And I will see you then. And so until then, Neil Miller, why don't you remind me what happened on Lost with your smooth voice?
I would love to. This episode that we're talking about today, The Last Recruit, was written by Paul Zbyszewski and Graham Rowland and directed by Stephen Semmel. It aired on April 20th, 2010. 420.
420!
And it takes place on days 10 and 11, because time moves more slowly on the island, following, of course, the arrival of Ajira Flight 316 on the island. We begin at Flock's camp, where Jack finally comes face-to-face with his old, formerly dead friend and his sister that he now knows is his sister. He also learns that the man in black, it was the man in black who had been walking around as his dead father back in season one, which answers perhaps one of Lost's oldest mysteries. Later, after Zoe shows up to threaten the camp with violence if they don't return Desmond, everyone springs into action. Locke tasks Saeed with executing Desmond in the well, and tells Sawyer to go get the sailboat, the Elizabeth, and bring it to a rendezvous point so that they can all go to Hydra Island and leave this entire damn place. The only problem is that Sawyer has his own plans. He and Kate get the boat and sail it to a different meeting spot where Jack, Hurley, Sun, Frank, and eventually Claire have arrived after sneaking away from the main group. Together, they plan to steal Widmore's sub and escape. On their way to Hydra Island, Jack and Sawyer have a classic disagreement about whether they should leave the island or stay and fight the man in black. Propelled by his sense of destiny, Jack ends up back in the water, swimming toward Flock. When the gang reaches Hydra Island, they realize they've been double-crossed by Widmore's people. Moments before, Widmore's people begin firing missiles at Smokey on the other island. Sun and Jin are finally reunited after all this time. Yeah, we waited all this time. In the flash sideways, Sun and Locke both arrive at the hospital pretty much simultaneously, to the point where Sun sees John Locke as she's being wheeled into the hospital. And while Sun and her baby ultimately are both fine, it's clear that Mr. Locke is going to need a very talented surgeon. Not sure where we're going to find one of those. While Kate is being held in custody at the police station, officers James and Miles are tasked with finding a suspect in a restaurant shooting. We know him as Saeed. They head to Nadia's house, where they catch Saeed with a surprisingly little amount of effort. I'm actually kind of disappointed in Saeed here. Elsewhere, Desmond meets Claire on her way to an adoption services meeting, and then generously and or creepily connects her with his lawyer friend Ilana Verdansky. As it turns out, Ilana is the lawyer who is about to read Christian Shepherd's will to the family. What a coincidence! Shortly after Jack and his son David arrive and meet Claire for the very first time, Jack is called away to the hospital to perform surgery on a substitute teacher who had been badly injured when he was struck by a car mere, I would assume, hours ago. The whole thing ends back at the beach on the main island, where missile fire is raining down around Jack and Flock as they try to patch things up or whatever. And after carrying Jack to safety, Flock has only one message: "You're with me now." Fun fact about this episode: this is the first multi-centric episode that isn't a premiere or finale. Usually they all center on a single character. At least one that has flashes to and from different timelines or realities or whatever. There is, of course, the other 48 days from season one.
Oh, yeah.
It sort of counts, but that was entirely flashback.
Right.
This is the first time that we've had a non-season premiere that is centered around a bunch of different characters, and this one has quite a few. This week's calm question: This is something I was wondering as Sawyer was playing out his plan, mm-hmm. which is if someone can leave the island easily with the bearings and the submarine, why wouldn't you just take the boat and sail away from the island? Why must we go get the sub?
Does Sawyer know the bearings?
Oh, I don't know if he knows the bearings. But he seems sure that he can get off the island with the sub.
Yeah, if he could use the sub.
I thought he could just, like, reverse engineer whatever bearings they took to get there in the first place.
Oh, sure. So he knows sub mechanics.
I don't know, man.
All I'm saying is that it feels like they're really wasting a trip here.
Because
at this point, they've got Jack, they've got Claire, they've got pretty much everything they need. I guess except for Jin.
Son wasn't leaving without Jin. But also,
sure.
Follow-up question.
Mm-hmm.
Would you rather leave the island on a submarine or on the Elizabeth?
I would probably take the sailboat.
I would take the Elizabeth, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. No.
Yeah.
Why would I be surrounded by the terrifying ocean?
No.
Right.
Never. I never want to go to submarine ever.
I mean, I think we talked about this a little bit when Desmond was trying to sail the Elizabeth out, that like maybe it's just like a bubble, right? Because they could shoot like rockets and stuff into it. We've seen with like the freighter season, and mm-hmm. the rockets apparently don't have to be like in a, you know, some sort of heading, or maybe they do and they just have to come in at an angle. But if right. it is a bubble,
they come in oddly timed.
Yeah. If it is a bubble, maybe the like shimmer or whatever that's keeping them in is above the water, which seems dumb. But you know, maybe they also need to get a Hume hole, and that's
What I'm suggesting is that the Hume hole does not exist only underwater, which it seems to be what Sawyer's plan require. You know, they need to be underwater to get off the island. I don't think that's true. I think they could have just sailed the boat. You know. They could have swung by the beach. Jin could have swam out. They could have gotten on this boat, and they could have left all this behind with four episodes to go.
The only thing that makes this somewhat okay to me is that is 100% something Sawyer would say, as somebody who went out on the first raft, was driven back to the island, and then lived with the Dharma people who are constantly subbing people on and off. So it makes sense in his sort of internal logic. He doesn't mm-hmm. know that the barrier also exists.
Sawyer's above water related trauma mm-hmm. is preventing him from seeing a solution here.
Yeah, I mean, the freighter got there and back again. I mean, most people on there lost their minds, but you know, that's fine. We're fine.
It did make it.
Did physically arrive, so, you know.
Yeah, it's an interesting episode for lots of reasons. I feel like it took us most of the season to get here, and this is what I really wanted to be happening earlier, which is something. But at the very least, as Neil mentioned, we finally get Jin and Sun coming along. But otherwise, we got some plans that move some people around, there is a lot of moving around. Which is why I think our first bullet point here in our discussion topic says place setting or chessboard episode, because we know we need certain people in certain places, and they start the episode not in those groupings and end the episode in the groupings we apparently need going forward. Because otherwise, why didn't they just start shooting things at Locke so early on, I guess. The Zoe and the Whitmores random plot seems to be the thing that has been holding us back from any sort of like really meaningful feeling of forward motion, because they are placed as impediments and then removed fairly quickly. Joanna, what's your favorite part of this episode?
What a good question. It's not the Sun and Jin. Can I start with the Sun and Jin reunion?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I think it falls really flat. So something I was trying to figure out why. Part of it is like that they keep cutting away from Sun and Jin to other people's reaction shots, and some of them are good. Like Sawyer gives a really good like I miss Juliet face, but like fucking Frank being like, looks like someone got their voice back. Like, what the hell?
And it's a really tough break for Frank because he's had some good one-liners this season, and this is like the worst of them.
It's a really bad one, and like. I think Takino really let us down. One of the recaps I was reading was, you know, sort of across the board, people were not impressed with this reunion. And I think part of it is like 29 episodes is a really long time to wait. You know, they strung this out for so long. And then it just felt kind of not as big of a moment as it needed to be. And I think someone was pointing out that usually those kinds of reunions are done without dialogue and it's just Giacchino.
Yeah. The reuniting on the beach and everybody hugs. I know what that looks like.
We've seen Sun and Jin do it like twice and I've cried. And like this time I was like, eh. And I cried in this final season, you know, like Abaterno makes me cry, and this should have made me cry, but it doesn't. And it feels just really flat. And another thing that I was sort of trying to think about is that, so this is directed by Stephen Semmel and written by Graham Rowland and I know Neil just pronounced it, but I don't know how I'm going to do with it. Paul Zbyszowski.
Zbyszowski? I don't know. I mean, that's as close as I'm going to ever get.
And they wrote Sundown in the Package this season, which I think were also two kind of subpar episodes. And Stephen Semmel is he's a longtime Lost editor. And directed just like a couple episodes, but basically these are not names that we've brought up before, and that's not necessarily like a disqualifier. Like Tucker, I think it's Tucker Gates directed Abaterno, and that's like an incredible episode, but that episode was written by Lindelof and Cuse, you know what I mean? And so like there are none of our like big names on this episode, and what I will say is I checked on the credits for the rest of the season, it's the last episode of the season where there isn't like one of those heavy hitters, like a Liz Sarnoff or a Kitsis and Horowitz or Jack Bender or, you know, someone is involved. And so this is the last time where it's like these three folks made an episode and it's fine. But it also happens to be the one where this big Sun and Jin moment happens and I just don't feel it. I don't know. What do you like, Neil? Do you feel it when Sun and Jin come
No, I agree completely. This actually reminds me of a conversation I think we were having on last week's episode where we talked about, like, what if Lost had really had, like, a big battle episode, right? Mm-hmm. Like, a big emotional showdown. This episode seems to want to do that in, like, 30 seconds. They want to start having some sort of Widmore v. Men in Black battle. And it comes right on the tail of this Sun and Jin moment. And I think that, you know, they don't give the reunion any time to breathe. And yeah, I mean, Giacchino sort of whiffs on this one. I just think that like what you've done is you've taken this huge moment, and whether or not they anticipated that this would be a huge moment for fans, you know, I sort of might inform the way that they thought about this, but you had to imagine that while they were writing this episode, they were thinking, okay, we've had these two characters apart for 29 episodes. We did so much amazing work early in this show to like overcome the way we set up Jin's character. And like the entire audience is rooting for Sun and Jin at this point for sure. And then you try to just sort of like plunk it in this episode where there's a million other things going on and the story has to move on very quickly. And I think that, you know, all of those things sort of create this perfect storm of this moment letting us down.
Yeah, it's not, I guess, great in the wide view of the season, which I'm sure we could talk about more in the storm. But it is like there are I like what Joanna was pointing out in terms of there not being any real heavy hitters here, because it feels like an episode that's trying to play a magic trick on you. Like, nothing happens. There are some things being drawn together on the island, and then the sideways, though, also definitely things being drawn together. So if anything, the idea that this is an episode where, like, you know, factions are made and drawn together is, like, the loosest idea this has to work with. And then they sort of, like, to distract from that, it feels like we get more explosions. They're random this time, since we blew up the dynamite last week when we thought, you know, explosions were getting too boring because we killed off Alana with an explosion. But let's not worry about that. Let's add some more explosions. That'll be fine. And then we'll have Jack jump off a boat in, like, a beautifully filmed sequence of, like, a boat and moving water, and it looks like the, you know, day was beautiful and it's lit great. Like it. But also, like, what was the point of that plot turn? It feels like a lot of it was just to get Jack to jump off a boat.
Mm-hmm. In his clothes with his backpack on, by mm-hmm. the way. I couldn't get that out of my mind.
So he could wash up in the plot convenient place.
How is he not sinking in his full clothes?
Listen, I really agree with you. It's sort of like the finale of Loki for me, where I see a really clumsy thing happening, which is like one character monologuing exposition for a full episode, and it works for me because, like, the actor's good. I agree with you that Jack jumping off the boat is, like, such a dumb, like, a character goes one direction and then backtracks immediately. But, like, and to go back to Locke alone is so dumb. But I think the way that they wrote that scene and the way that Matthew Fox and Josh Holloway performed it, it really worked for me. I mean, first of all, let's be grateful, I guess, that Sawyer actually has something to do this episode.
Right.
It's been a minute.
Finally, his sub plan from 3 weeks ago.
But I think, you know, and then Jack, like, apologizing for Juliet and, like, doing all of his, like, man of faithing stuff that he's doing there, like his John Locke echoing, like, it all worked. It's so dumb, but also it works, I think.
Well, I think they're conversations that need to happen. They're placed together in a weird order for me.
Mm-hmm.
Like this whole idea that, like, Jack's hiking along with everybody, like, to the boat, and then maybe can't have that conversation with Sawyer because, like, Claire shows up, but then also doesn't have that conversation with Kate. Like, wouldn't you do that conversation right before you leave the dock? I would think so. Because, like, wouldn't he want more people on his side? Maybe he doesn't. The apologizing to Juliet thing is great. So whatever Saeed does at the well, like, is something that needed to happen because Saeed was just doing
nothing. I think we can say definitely not kill Desmond. I think we can all just safely say that Desmond Hume did not die off screen in a well.
Oh, that, you just took away our Island Jungle of Mystery moment.
Oh, sorry.
Because everything else in this episode is spelled out so directly in the jungle.
The most mysterious, least mysterious thing that happens in this episode.
Yep. But even, like, that emotional beat, it's a conversation that needed to happen. But it's weird that it's Desmond. Like, I get the weird...
Ooh, like, yeah,
no connection to Saeed. The only connection they have is they both are, like, helplessly in love with women. And then...
I mean, they were together on the ship for the Constant a little bit.
I mean, it's not that they don't know each other. It's just, like, why is Desmond the one to be like, hey, maybe you shouldn't be killing people? And why does that work?
Yeah.
Like, if it took was somebody asking Saeed, like, is it really worth it? Like, why didn't somebody ask him that back in before Sawyer wrote him off as, like, a zombie and not worth it, you know?
Yeah. Well, it's another one of those moments where I'm sitting there thinking, this is dumb. Why is Desmond in a well? Why do we need to, you know, have these characters in this scene together? But then they make it work because the two actors are just so good in that little moment where Desmond's trying to, like, talk Saeed out of shooting him. And it's like, damn, this show, the characters.
Yeah, you know? I guess to answer your earlier question, Dave, about like my favorite part of this episode, it all kind of like ripples out from this one moment for Hurley. Hurley doesn't have a lot to do in this episode. I went through the transcript and he has like 7 lines or something like that. You know, like after his like big leadership moment, right? He's like passing the torch literally off to other people. But he has his Star Wars moment, right? Where like Sawyer's like, here's the plan. We're leaving Claire. We're leaving Saeed, right? And Hurley, like in the Luke Skywalker role, is like, yeah, but you can always bring people back from the dark side. I mean, Anakin, right? And then like funny response from Sawyer, who the hell is Anakin, right? That's funny. But like that attitude coming from Hurley ripples out to what Desmond does for Saeed and what Kate does for Claire. And Kate with Claire is one of my favorite parts of this episode, mostly because like Sawyer getting a plan to plan, hallelujah, Evangeline Lilly gets some fucking emotions to act, right? And I think Kate convincing Claire to come with them is a genuinely good part of this episode. And I think that idea of like these two characters, when so much of Lost or so much of the island rules about Lost are about this black and white binary of morality, and how we thought that that was so much in conflict with like what the show had been telling us, which is like everyone can be redeemed, everyone, second chances are available to everyone, like morality is gray, all this sort of stuff like that. I think it's really important that we have Hurley say this thing and then we see it in action with Kate and with Desmond reaching out to Saeed and to Claire. So that stuff in this episode I really like. I don't know. What do you guys think?
No, I agree. I think it's a strong moment for Kate and Claire. It just feels like finally they gave Kate something useful to do on the island in this season, you know?
Well, she finally gets to do the thing she came back to the island for.
Yeah. Yeah. It feels like, you know, we've been talking a lot about like arcing out. It feels like sort of this is where Kate's arc sort of hits its final stride, right? I mean, sure, we're like 4 episodes from the end, but you know, it finally is sort of out in the open that this was Kate's entire purpose for coming back to the island, and now she's convinced Claire to at least come along with them, and I think it's just a good win for Kate, you know?
And a little bit for Claire, as this is the first time she has ever left the main island since the series began.
Claire. Oh,
you also made it off.
I feel like someone in the wig department gave her wig like a little, like, I don't think they washed it, but it feels like they maybe like beat it against a wall a bit to get like
they
the
gave
majority
it a little
of
tease.
The dust. Yeah.
They're like, well, this can't make it worse, so let's try something.
It's sort of like when you whack a rug with a tennis racket. That's sure. I think what they did to the wig. So yeah.
Jack has, it seems like he's going to have a lot of action at the beginning of the episode because he gets to sit down with Locke and have a good conversation. But then he ends the episode and he seems like he would be the titular last recruit. Mm-hmm. Neil, how do you think, how did you track Jack's mental state in this episode?
Well, I mean, I think it's interesting that this episode is sort of bookended by Jack and Locke stuff. I wonder if, like, some of Jack's actions confuse me in this episode. Like, if his, at what point did he realize that he needed to, you know, go back and, I guess, confront Locke, or Flock, sorry. Because why would he do all of this other nonsense? Like, why would he go along with this boat plan? Why wouldn't he just stay and send everyone else away? So yeah, it's Jack feels like he's caught in a weird like loop where he just sort of ends up back where he was, but he got to have a few conversations with, you know, Sawyer along the way. Yeah, I just don't, it's Jack's kind of a hard one to read. I feel like his, what little we get from him in the sideways is sort of more useful than what we get of him on the island. Because, like, for example, he doesn't really deal with the whole Claire thing, especially at the beginning of the episode, when it's like, all right, Jack's back at this camp. he's now going to confront Locke, and then he meets Claire in the context that they are siblings, and they don't really do anything with that. Nothing. You know, they do more in the sideways in like a 30-second scene. So you know, Jack's a little confusing, but Jack is probably the piece on the chessboard that is being sort of moved around the most at this point, and that can get a little tedious. You know, because it, you know, we had problems with Sawyer and Kate being left in one place on the chessboard for a long time with nothing to do, and Jack seems like he's got a lot to do, but he also seems to be like ping ponging in between everyone else's storylines. You know,
I mean, is that a function of Jack being in the like in the passive role?
Maybe
that he is, yeah. in the fact that he's like following Hurley's lead, and then he's like enacting Sawyer's plan, and then he's like, you know, like he's not leading because he's
sure
scared to.
Well, or, and then you know, him jumping off the boat is Jack making sort of a big decision. Mm-hmm. You know, almost like Jack taking back some sort of control or some sort of leadership of at least his own path. And, you know, that has not always worked out well for Jack, making big decisions like that.
I think it's interesting he leans so hard into it and maybe is resistant to it and therefore leads people to the boat in the first place because of the speech from Flock at the beginning. And the recontextualizing of what John Locke was, mm-hmm. or the attempted recontextualizing. Look, there's an antagonist check-in from the smoke monster on John Locke at the beginning of this episode, and whether or not you agree with him, he's been making the dumb argument I've been making for seasons, which is blind faith isn't necessarily something that should be admired because it is also dangerous. To like you and other people, just the idea that you could be swindled by like these bad gods. I'm not completely against it, but I am like, stop shit talking my boy, because the show has now put me in a protective position for not a live lock. So it's,
well, it's also put Jack in that position, right?
Yeah, I think Jack at this point got a little too much. No, maybe he was expecting it. The question he asks about, you know, what are you and were you my dad? It feels like a question that is answered mostly for the audience. So I had to stop and think about, like, how long had Jack been considering this? You know, like, why is that the first thing that jumps to his mind? He learns that the smoke monster can replicate dead people. So immediately he's like, my dad?
I it makes sense to me. It's not immediate, right? Because he's known that there's a person out there who looks like John Locke, he just hasn't seen it yet, right? But he's known for a couple episodes.
Right, so either he's been sitting around being like, is there something that could be other dead people?
I think he's like, oh my god, I thought I was having this major experience seeing my dead dad, but if there's a thing out there that can impersonate dead people, doesn't it make sense that it wasn't my dead dad, it was this fucking smoke monster?
Does that make him feel better, do you think? I don't think there's an answer in the show.
Well, the other thing we need to debate is, and we talked about this in the storm before, but welcome to the calm. When was the Man in Black Christian Shepherd? It is a point that continues to be debated by Lost fans, because you might feel cleanest to say every single time it was mm-hmm. him, but here are a few. I was digging into many a Reddit thread earlier today to try to figure out sort of like what the consensus is around people, because there isn't like an official statement. There is confirmation that yes, that first time
white
when
rabbit.
He's looking for water, White Rabbit, that is definitely the Man in Black. But the question is,
he turned himself into ice cubes to make some ice cube sounds.
Tinkle, tinkle. But like, is Christian Shepherd in the hospital off island the Man in Black, or is that actually the ghost of Christian Shepherd, or is that a drug hallucination from Jack? Is Christian Shepherd on the freighter with Michael, the Man in Black, or is it actually Christian Shepherd? Is the guy who talked to Locke about the donkey wheel thing Christian Shepherd, or is it the Man in Black? I think when we were watching it, we were interpreting it this most recent time as that's the Man in Black talking to him. But the question is, like, why does he say hi to my son for me? And why mm-hmm. would he, I mean, I think we asked at the time, why would he appear as Christian Shepherd, who would like have no, like, why wouldn't he be like Echo? Someone right. who would have more, or Boone, someone who would have like more of an emotional impact on Locke than Christian Shepherd, who he's never seen in his life.
But it was in the past. You know, can ghost time travel?
Sure.
It was in the past. Why would the Man in Black know what Christian Shepherd looks like in the past?
That's yes.
Many hundreds of years before Christian Shepherd ever existed.
Welcome to what the storm sounds like a lot of the time. Go back to White Rabbit now and check out the storm. Well, I guess not yet. When we finish the season, you could go back and it's lots of these debates.
Yeah. Although they could have fixed this, because Jack could have just been like, but what about those other times? And Flock could have been like, what do you mean other times?
I was spiders one time.
That's my favorite of our theories. Or someone could have said, someone like named Carlton Cuse or David Lindelof could have said, here are all the times that the Man in Black was. But something we've talked about a lot in the storm, but I don't know that we've talked about on the call, but maybe we have, is that there are three things on a board that said, like, that they weren't quite identified, and it was Yemi, Kate's horse, and Christian Shepherd. So these are like three. It's just more complicated than he was.
These
definitely
are the ultimate
the Man
jungle
in Black.
Mysteries.
Yeah, right. That he was definitely Man in Black the entire time. We can be confident that he was the Man in Black when he was luring Claire. And we mm-hmm. be confident he was the Man in Black with the water stuff, and maybe a few other times. But, you know, there's some other question marks that people continue to debate. So search your heart.
And well, we also good storytellers deferring an answer. They introduce this solution one mere episode after we learn that ghosts can just manifest on the island whenever they feel like it, because it's been the whispers. They've been there all along.
Sure. Well, and part of it could be part of the con, right? Because one of the things that the Man in Black is trying to communicate to the candidates at this point, people like Jack, is I'm cool. Jacob was keeping you here. I was trying to help you. I help you
I'm
find
cool
water. Right? Like this comes back to the Saeed thing too. Like, he has convinced Saeed that he can bring back the woman that he loved, who is now dead.
Right.
Which we don't think he can do, and Desmond's probably right when he's like, are you sure? so that it I'm not saying that he's lying about being Christian Shepherd at the beginning. He probably was. But it is still sort of part of the long con that the Man in Black is playing, where he's like, I'm just a friend to all these candidates. I just believe that humans should be free and be able to do whatever they want. And they shouldn't be brought to this island and whatnot. And we don't, it's hard to know if we can trust that.
It's the mystery of what things can manifest on the island will not get clearer, I don't think, but as we continue going through the series.
Mm-hmm. It will be. Michael's not going to scroll back out of the jungle and tell us.
There's some rules. If they're wet, they're a ghost.
So anyway, Man in Black, Christian Shepherd. It's a thing.
Confirmed-ish.
Confirmed sometimes. I also really liked the part where Claire, this is a good, I've knocked Emily DeRaven's acting before and I stand by that, but I think this episode, when she has to play like, he's the only one who didn't leave me.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's not really fair, Claire, because they were looking for you and you left your baby on a leaf and you wandered into the jungle, but she's been traumatized and gaslit and all this sort of stuff like that. So I think her playing that, and then her saying that, and then her seeing, like, Jack and his pals immediately just peace out without her. The fact that Jack has no conflict over leaving his sister Claire.
And no excuse, because now he knows that's his sister.
That's just some real fucked up shit. I mean, I'm glad it's Kate is the one who's, like, insisting that she come, but I'm like, Jack, my dude.
Yeah. Okay. If we left this all up to Jack and Sawyer, Claire would never have any chance of making it out this island.
Jack is also real lucky that Kate's been taking all the heat when it was like, and I could have raised Aaron and, given him a full family, but I was not into that.
Yeah, don't ask me what Jack was doing at the time.
It was,
kind of half raising his own nephew.
That being said, Claire on Island, I get what you're saying, Joanna. It's not horrible. Claire off Island is the Claire.
Yeah.
Claire character prime, which is, yeah, I'm pregnant and I have no idea what's going on, and I'll just do whatever anybody tells me to do.
Whatever this creepy man who was on my flight tells me to do.
Anybody. It's a psychic. It's her shitty artist boyfriend. She will do anything someone tells her to do.
Yeah, you want to talk about amenable to coercion. Claire.
Seriously.
Claire.
And Desmond, I mean, this is like, this is peak Desmond creep, right? Desmond peeking over a lady's shoulders to get her full name and to be like, I see you're going to an adoption agency. Like, Desmond,
yeah,
my guy.
Yeah. Yeah, like, we could write off a chance encounter at Mr. Cluck's with Hurley. But this one's really on the nose. Creepy. And we know that, like, you know, Minkowski got Desmond a list of where all these people are going to be, but we didn't know it was going to be this detailed. Like, oh, here's Claire's address. Here's Claire's calendar. Here's where she's going to be.
I mean, I don't even know how you would know that. Yeah, it was just like, anyway, like, let's just believe he has a ton of resources. Heck, maybe even Hurley's helping him. We don't know yet because Hurley's not in the sideways in this episode. But yeah, that whole maneuvering of Claire, it's a real creep-tastic moment for Desmond Hume. Like, it takes every ounce of Henry and Cusick's charm to not make me mad. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, like, in order for this to be okay, you have to know that they are connected across multiple universes and that he is somehow fulfilling, or at least believes he's fulfilling, some sort of cosmic destiny by doing this. Otherwise, this is the weirdest shit.
Yeah. Dave, I have a question for you.
Yeah, go for it.
How do you feel about how Alana manifests in the sideways world?
Well, I'm sorry that we probably said her last name in the calm to clarify that she was Russian. I didn't realize it didn't come out until here.
But it still doesn't matter.
Yeah, still doesn't matter. Alana needs to stop getting entangled in the posthumous dealings of white men. Go live a life, woman. You were the best when you were just, you know, going on a date with Saeed. Like, do more of that. Good God.
That is true. I mean, we don't know.
Posthumous dealings of white men. Neil, what do you think of Alana? Lawyer Alana.
I mean,
Alana Esquire.
It's fun. It's a fun place to put Alana. Like, I can't think of anywhere else in the sideways, at least so far, that Alana would have, like, fit. But I like the idea that, you know, all of these sort of secondary and maybe third tier characters, if we want to be real harsh about what Alana is, that they're popping up in the sideways in different ways. So I think this is a perfectly, like, fine place for her to show up, and, you know, she's just there to sort of basically be a fun cameo. I don't know if we learn anything new about Alana. Like, I don't think any of this is about her. This is just more about, like, here she is without an accent, and isn't that great? Yes.
Well, I think we could start to tell in the sideways which characters, you know, are important enough to be drawn together, because they are being drawn to the hospital now, bit by bit.
Yeah, like Jack's son David.
Yeah.
Incredibly important.
A criticism I have of, so we've done our last character-centric Flash, right? Like, the Hurley episode last week is the last one.
Yes.
I can say that, I think. Mm-hmm. So this is more of a melange of perspectives.
That follows the sequence of the numbers, which is weird.
Like, the order in which we see the candidates.
Yes, this is from my Lostpedia, and when I read it, I shook my head because I don't know if it was intentional or not. But the first Flash was John Locke's number 4. The second was James Ford's number 15. The fourth was Saeed Jarrah's number 16. Skip over Hurley. Jack Shepard's 23. And the last was Sonny Jin's 42.
Okay.
Wow.
I mean, I don't It's one of those things I don't like. Like, just, right. just show me the story how it happened.
Because it's like, if that was intentional, it's like, oh, you put a lot of energy into making that intentional, and then you totally whiffed the Sun and Jin reunion? Come on.
Yeah, you kept it towards the end, I guess, because they were number 42? Like, not great. But I do like the drawing together. I do like the sort of momentum. Go ahead.
Well, the thing that I was going to say is that, like, yeah, the momentum, but it, once again, it's even more of, I think, a chess piece moving thing in the sideways than it is even on Island, getting people to the lawyers, getting people to the hospital, etc. Because, like, it's, the sideways is not doing any work for me in terms of revealing to me things about the characters as they relate to what's happening on Island. The way in which we think Lost is best at, the way in which you're always asking the question about Dave, right?
Well, and so yeah. I mean, there are some hints that Sun seems to recognize John Locke when he's being wheeled into the hospital, and that moment was important enough to alter time in the sense that, like, Sun and Jin were off Oceanic Flight 816, like 15. For like a couple of days, and then Sun got shot. But like, it's been a week for people like John Locke since they got off the flight. So that's obviously an important meeting. And then there's our mirror moment. Sorry to like spoil it, but Jack seems to like recognize Locke through a mirror in like the surgery. Mm-hmm. And the music cue makes me wonder if there's more crossover between like the sideways in the main line. So they still want us.
It's not just like, well, oh, this is a, like, guy I had a conversation with, like, the airport.
Yeah,
I don't mean like bleed, I mean like emotionally and character.
Yes,
do you know what I mean? And so like for example, one of the more enjoyable, I think, flash sideways moments is like Kate and Sawyer in the police precinct, right? Because, mm-hmm. like, it's just Evangeline Lilly and Josh Holloway splashing around in their chemistry, doing their little, like, flirty game-recognized from, like, whatever the case may be and stuff like that, early season one stuff. And it's that kind of nostalgia stuff that has worked in this season. Like, whenever we see an old character, and we're like, oh, remember so-and-so. It's so fun to see them. Remember how much we loved the show at the beginning. And we still love the show, but, like, remember how much we loved at the beginning. But, like, that interaction between Kate and Sawyer does nothing for what is going on with Kate and Sawyer on the island right now, I think. You know what I mean? And right. So it's just like a nostalgia play for me. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, that's fine. And all in all, I've liked the sideways more than the on island stuff this season. But I think that's why this episode feels so like weirdly empty, despite all the things that are going on, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, as Neil pointed out, Saeed goes down with a hose because he doesn't look down when he's exiting doors, which seems like super.
I mean, Saeed
one.
Forgot the first rule of this whole thing, which is don't fall down.
Don't fall down.
Oh,
got tripped by a damn hose.
But that's a slick move on Sawyer's part, right?
Oh, for sure.
I mean,
for sure.
Covering the back. Good job, Sawyer. But also, I would assume that if he's a good enough police officer, he could have done something better than the hose.
I didn't even think about Saeed for the Falling Down Award, and spoiler alert, he's not the person I put in for the Falling Down Award, but that's a good call. Tripped on a hose.
Yeah. Tripped on a hose.
Like I said in my intro, surprisingly low effort arrest of a character who we believe to be very high powered. It's almost like it was Saeed and Miles and the universe conspiring to catch, or I'm sorry, it was Sawyer and Miles and the universe conspiring to catch Saeed, because I don't know. I don't think two random LA cops are going to get it done normally for Saeed.
Correct.
Like, he's going to be able to evade those guys.
Correct.
Is that supposed to, I guess before he gets captured, he tells Nadia he can never see her again, and he has to go away. Are we supposed to somewhat connect that to Saeed's unseen decision on the island? Did he give
let
up Nadia?
Go. Hmm. I like that. Sure.
Maybe. Yeah.
I'll take it. I'll give the episode points for this.
Yeah, if we're looking for connection, we're gonna squeeze every drop of water out of this rock.
I love that you did that. Follow up question for one of you, maybe Neil. When John Locke says Helen Norwood, I was gonna marry her. Do you think that's intentionally vague enough that either version of Locke, either awake Locke or not, would have said that?
Wait. I've been waiting 52 minutes. Good God. I feel like a real Son and Jenny with that joke. Took me 29 episodes.
Yeah, I mean, it is. It is vague enough to be potentially either version of John Locke. You know, but it's interesting because this is starting to sort of pose more questions about what's happening to these characters as they're remembering, you know, they seem to be remembering their other lives. They don't seem to necessarily be connecting, like, with what's happening currently on the island, right? So it's like, you know, like Desmond, do we think Desmond has any conscious knowledge? Desmond on island has any conscious knowledge of the Flash Sideways? Maybe Desmond's a bad example because
he breaks all the rules.
He breaks all the time rules. I mean, like, there's nothing for John Locke in the Sideways to connect with on the island because he's dead and now being used as a meat suit by the Man in Black. But if he is remembering things, yeah, Helen is Helen John's constant? Maybe. I think so. I think that any version of John Locke in that situation might be calling out about Helen.
It seems like even if you aren't Desmond, your memories to the main timeline get closer the closer you are to death.
Yeah.
Sure. Yeah.
Exactly. So, like, is he woken up, you know, the same way that, like, Son is slightly woken up when she's, like, freaked out about John?
You know with I mean? With the exception of Hurley, of course, who just needed to kiss Libby, and now he's good.
Yes. Interesting. Interesting logic. I don't think we can answer any of these questions right now, but good to keep an eye on it. Joanna, give me the download on David, who once again shows up without any other Davids, so we could assume he's all the Davids.
Final David?
There's a couple questions we have here, right? Prime okay, David. First of all, I got really emotional when... okay, well, actually, I need to start with the other thing first. First of all, we still don't know who his mom is. Still being kept a mystery. Right? But when Jack gets on his flip phone to call David's mom and say he'll bring him home by 5, and David gives him the old, like, and he's like, never mind, later, because we're going to have dinner. It's so cute, is it not? What do you guys think?
Oh, I mean, it's a great Jack moment, you know, to show how good of a dad he is in the Sideways, and just how much more evolved he is than the Jack that we see, even the Jack that we see jumping off the boat with Sawyer. You know, I'm still not sure that version of Jack is a good dad. This one, yeah, I think he's figured it out finally.
Well, and I think that Matthew Fox's performance is too, like, he's just so, like, pleased in the way that, like, parents who are used to getting nothing from their children and get, like, a nice little sweet moment from them are. I don't know. What do you think, Dave?
No, I like Jack learning how to be a good dad because he's gonna finally bury his old dad, but then, no shit, he has a sister. Like, I like that rolling along because it's similar to the Jack on the island. It's a Jack who's rolling with the punches more than he's making declarative decisions. So, like, back when he first met Locke in the Sideways at the baggage claim, he was, like, pissed. He's like, you know, how they lose my father. This is, like, going to destroy all the things. And then he realized he just needed to focus on his son in his Flash episode. And now he's let that go. Like, this is a Jack that doesn't have that baggage on him. And it's fun to see. Almost as fun to see an actually humble Jack on the Island of Mystery.
It's, I don't know, it's interesting to me because, like, the moment where Jack has to Jack finds out about Claire and the sideways. And then he finds out about his dad's infidelity. That's a real moment. Like, that's a good echo of Christian Shepherd. Like, is Christian Shepherd who you think he is across both timelines, right? And, like, that question of infidelity is something that's really kind of sticking to me because I was thinking about The Leftovers, and obviously we may or may not be talking more about The Leftovers at some point, you guys, but, like, The Leftovers, this next show that Lost did, it, like, you know, if the preoccupation with, like, Jack and Christian and Kevin Garvey, who's Justin Theroux's character on Lost, they're all, like, sort of examinations of, like, Damon Lindelof trying to figure out his shit with his dad and stuff like that, and himself and how he feels about being a leader and all sort of stuff like that. This theme of infidelity crops up across both of those timelines. And I'm just wondering, that's not something that we've, like, thought about, but that being like an ultimate betrayal of a father figure, or a particular kind of betrayal of a father figure. Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, secret second family is a big one.
Yeah, yeah.
On the bad dad
on the
scale,
bad dad list. Not great.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I like how he absorbs it in the sideways more than how he absorbed it at the funeral in the real world. But yeah, you guys, you're right. They should have done more with it on the island instead of just being like, hey, and they also know their siblings here.
Weird.
Sometimes structure doesn't work out like the note cards make it look. All right. I feel like the rest of the stuff, we're going to be back on the island. Yeah. Close out on the island.
I think so.
Talking about
We still. I think one other than who is David's mom. Another mystery we have left is what was Sawyer doing in Australia?
Mm-hmm.
In the sideways, we don't know the answer to that.
We don't know, but you know, I mean, we know that he didn't want his partner to know, but Kate does make a good point that, like, him letting someone who's clearly on the run from the police go means that it wasn't just that he didn't want his partner to know. Like, he was doing something that he really didn't want, like, everybody to know.
He just seems way too jaunty on that plane ride to have just murdered someone. So I don't think he killed Angela's drama teacher outside the shrimp shack in Australia. I don't know. What do you think, Dave? What was he up to?
Well, I guess I'm going to have to headcanon it because we don't know. But I'm going to say that whichever Sawyer he's actually named after now might not be Locke's father, might not be our Anthony Cooper. And so I would assume doing some research onto, you know, tracking down his case. Because that seems to be the thing that's very secret in Sideways James's life. And maybe there's a big surprise that would feel more revelatory than that, but otherwise I'm going to write it up as he was probably doing detective stuff. Off the books detective stuff.
Okay. Secret cop stuff. Works for me.
Yeah, and you can't, like, tell a boss because, like, you know who doesn't have jurisdiction in Australia? The LAPD. Cool. Alright, back to the island. We have a different method of leadership here from Locke. He finally has everybody together, but we are beyond the period of time. I think after he smashes the radio and says, here we go, we're beyond the period of time of Locke giving large speeches, it sounds like. He's breaking people off. He's got teams of people he thinks he can trust. They both kind of betray him in a certain way this episode. And who is he left with? Jack. The one person he tried to earworm in. So, Neil, I have a question.
Mm-hmm.
When Claire says you were already on his team the second you let him talk to you, is that when it happened? Or did Jack make a choice to return to Locke at some point?
Well, I mean, I definitely think Jack makes a choice, especially in that conversation with Sawyer on the boat. But I do think it is a good point to bring up that he's not the same kind of leader, or the same kind of influencer that the original John Locke was, right? Because the original John Locke loved to give a speech, you know, and he did pull people aside, you know, especially at the beginning. He sort of had his own little clique with Boone and Walt. But yeah, this version, the Man in Black version of Locke, is significantly sneakier. And, you know, I think that helps inform Jack changing his mind. That helps inform Claire's decision to, you know, join up with Kate and leave the island, because it's like, you know, these characters can sense that, you know, even though that looks like John Locke, they know for sure that it's not. And they can also kind of sense that this dude is not on the level, you know, like even Saeed, who has been literally poisoned by the well, you sort of see it come through at the end where he's like, can I really trust this guy? Is he going to give me what I want? Probably not. I should probably be looking out for myself and, you know, maybe some of these other people that I've been on this island with, you know?
Yeah. It's gonna be interesting to see how willing Jack is to be on the side of this person after basically getting blown up. Which,
yeah, I mean, old Smokey can say that Jack's with him now all he wants, but I don't think I believe that Jack believes that.
The title could be the last recruit as long as it wants to be. Maybe Claire was the last recruit to get off the island. You don't know. Sure. I like it.
Yeah.
Speaking of blowing up Joanna, can you blow up the Spoke Monster?
Seems like you wouldn't be able to, and I don't know why Charles Winmore would think that you
right.
Seems like a really dumb plan.
Shouldn't we be expecting more from Chuck Widmore at this point?
We lost a bunch of meat socks, though, didn't we? Okay, well, let me
well,
just track
I mean,
something.
Others, yes.
Let me track something really important really quickly. We do see Cindy and the kids.
Mm-hmm.
I am outraged that Sawyer did not include Cindy and the kids on his list of people to get off the island. However, they were not on the beach when the bombs fell. So once again, Cindy and the kids are safe.
Right. Well, it's really, because Cindy is not on Team Locke. Cindy is just here to protect those damn kids.
Oh, yeah. She's on Team Cindy.
Well,
Zach and Emma.
Was there ever a period in time where Sawyer was around Cindy and would even know that she was on the plane?
Well, first of all, she's a very memorable flight attendant. Secondly, they were outside the bear cages.
They were.
Oh, yeah, Island. You're right.
So
yeah, I guess that's what
they,
that's
and
what
they
went, did.
They and they went back. The they carried. They helped carry him through the forest, the jungle, back from the beach, and that's when Cindy got disappeared. Remember, Sawyer was like kind of dying, and Cindy got disappeared. So Sawyer's had some history with good old Cindy, and if he knew, he should know better. He should, like, I'm just saying, they don't end this episode in the greatest position, right? They're under, like, Zoe's got her gun on them on the beach, right?
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just saying, if he had Cindy with him, he would have been
sure.
Fine.
Maybe Cindy fine. And the kids would know a different pathway or something like that, secret route exactly. To get to, but yeah, I mean, as far as Sawyer is concerned, Claire, Cindy, Zach, Emma, they all belong to the island now. He's like, I'm ready to go.
They belong to the streets.
Right.
Yeah, but yeah, so I just want you guys to know, Cindy and the kids were not on the beach when those bombs dropped, but also that was a dumb plan, Charles Widmore. Real dumb.
To loop back to something that I pointed out sort of at the beginning of the episode and didn't realize, we have this very insightful note about it that probably makes it feel a little bit better. Joanna, when was the last time we saw a dude wearing jeans jump off of mass transit system into the water to go back to the island?
Oh, was it Sawyer out of the helicopter?
It was. And here we have the reversal between these two characters, one of which, perfectly fine getting off the island, and the other one doesn't necessarily need to leave. Granted, he's not doing it to save Kate this time, but there has been a direct character reversal of where Sawyer and Jack were the first time around, where Jack was willing to do anything to get people off the island, make deals with the freighter people, etc., while as Sawyer was perfectly happy to not go back to a place that consider him a murderer.
Yeah, and both times Kate was like, no. but the thing that's a little different, it is a nice flip-flop, and that is something I put in the notes. But I think that something that's a little different is that Sawyer's running away from and that's a thing, that's a note that I have. I think I put in the storm, but I think I can bring it up here. Sawyer's motivation right now is to get away from anything that reminds him of Juliet, right? Like that, that's what is giving him his mania to leave. I don't think that's as compelling as running towards something, running away from something, right? It's not a compelling character-wise. So my question is, like, why aren't he and Kate maybe talking about Clementine more? Like, something for Sawyer to run towards, rather than just being haunted by something, you know?
Yeah. Because then they need to cast Clementine, and that's like another child actor, and Lost just doesn't like it.
We met her. She's like, hi, Aunt Kate, or whatever. She's
oh, yeah,
there.
That's right. They were playing on the floor. Oh, yeah. Oh, more baby. More baby casting.
Okay.
All right. Ben, Miles, and Richard, not here. They're off doing some other plan. I wonder if that's going to pay off in any sort of way. Or they got accidentally blown up in the jungle and we didn't see it. Who knows what the last season of Lost.
But Richard's the only one who's not in the episode. Because Ben and Miles are in the sideways. But other than that, every single other cast member is in this episode for the first time, I think, in a long time.
Richard had to cede his appearance to Alana.
Would have been a good spot for Richard to show up in the sideways as the lawyer.
Yeah, well, the lawyer.
I wonder.
Another guy trapped in posthumous white dude shit.
Free yourself, Richard.
Yeah, and then explain to me this bullet that just says purgatory. Because I'm pretty sure we weren't in purgatory on the island.
No, we're not in purgatory on the island. It's just sort of like that. It was just me thinking about that, like, whole second chances thing. That whole, like, tabula rasa stuff. And just sort of, like, what the island is. It's not literally purgatory, as far as we know. But it's, like, it's this space in between. This, like, place to prove yourself. And that just goes back to that thing I was saying about Hurley and, like, it's never too late to bring someone back from the dark side sort of stuff, which I like.
An island where the forces of good and evil can battle it out. That sounds like a good TV show.
But also, because we didn't hit it hard enough, let's just reinstate the fact that Sun, the whole plot where Sun forgets how to speak English, is so dumb. And it's so dumb, and then it just comes back when she sees Jin, and that's it, and it's dumb. The end. Full stop. Hated it.
Yeah, she needed to not be able to speak English long enough to write a John Locke one note, and then that's it.
You did this to me. I didn't do anything to you. I'm gonna walk over here now.
Yeah. God. He's like, I know how this episode ends. You'll be fine by the time we're done here.
It'll be good. I saw the cast list. It's gonna, you got just. Hold on for a few more scenes. All right, it's time for corners. Neil, we got a Giacchino corner this week.
Well, this one is sort of related to the Sun and Jin thing, because as we've been talking about, they really sort of phoned it in with how they dealt with Sun and Jin, and that's true of Giacchino as well. There are several tracks on this episode that are, you know, rich mixes of different motifs, 4 or 5 different characters, motifs all getting woven into, you know, one thing. There's a track called The Last Recruit that's from this episode that includes stuff from the Destiny theme, the home theme, Locke's theme, Desmond's theme, even a little bit of the medical motif, which, you know, big news when the medical motif shows up. But then there's this track called Sunny Outlook, which is basically a small variation of the main titles theme, the credits theme of Lost, and it's what plays over the scene with Sun and Jin in the hospital and the flash sideways. And it's just like, they really just, everything related to Sun and Jin, they just, huge whiff. Even Giacchino was like, yeah, just throw in the closing credits theme, it'll be fine.
Boo. All right, our jungle mystery moment is one that we already answered for you. It was, is Desmond okay? He's fine. They're not going to shoot Desmond off screen.
Remember Game of Thrones and how we would constantly be debating back and forth whether or not Game of Thrones would kill a main character off screen? Lost isn't going to do it either.
Not the time in the series to be start making Game of Thrones comparisons. It makes me feel nervous. The Boone Carlyle Memorial Falling Down Award goes to Jack, who in one of the larger stunts in the season gets blown up. Don't be too worried for Jack. He's back in the island's good graces, though, so I imagine he's pretty hard to kill. Like, they already tried to, blow himself up with dynamite, didn't work. So,
like, the explosions look kind of chintzy, but that, like, whatever they did to put Matthew Fox on a wire looked pretty good.
Yeah.
Yeah, and Saeed wins an alternate award, which is the Falling Down Award that's likely to be replicated by people who watch Lost and listen to this podcast.
Which is, I tripped over the hose.
I don't think any of us are likely to get almost hit by a missile on a random island of mystery, but tripping over a hose is a pretty normal way to fall down.
That's a Tuesday for me.
The John Locke Memorial Coming Back Award. Hey, there's Alana. Remember her?
She's already back.
She got blown into the sideways. Our Abs Eterno Award is going to go to James Sawyer, captain of the Elizabeth, at least for this episode. Or maybe sharing with Kate to be Captain Elizabeth. But the Abs, it goes to Sawyer. Through the looking glass we already talked about, there's a mirror that allows Jack to recognize John Locke in the sideways right before some surgery happens. Wonder how that's going to go.
It's a cool moment, right?
Yeah.
It's Jack's face, and then it's John's face. And of all the mirror moments, like, all the mirror moments feel like they were leading up to the mirror where Jack turns into John. Like, come on.
I want to take his face off. The Ben's talking, so it's obviously a lie award. This may be hard for you to believe, Jack, but all I've ever been interested in is helping you. That comes from the evil monster. The one that's represented by the Black Stone.
The one who killed 99% of the tail section.
It seems not like a lot of help's been happening there. Spot the difference, Coroner. Ilana, very Russian last name. No Russian accent.
I think she's so much better without that dumb accent.
Mm-hmm. Agreed.
I really like her in the sideways. She's got great hair, no accent, good stuff.
Well, I'm going to skip then to the Charlie Pace Memorial Final Words Award. No, I'm sorry. That's an entirely different character. I just saw two names that ended in A. Let's not skip anything. It's time for the Jungle of Kistery. This is where you, the listeners...
You could have connected it through weird accents that are a little shaky if you wanted to. Okay, Jungle of Kistery moment.
Yeah.
This is the
Who
moment
should be kissing
on the podcast.
For Everybody Loves You. Oh, you were going to do it.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, do it.
Okay. This is something we do every week, and we decide who should be kissing on the island. So for last week's Everybody Loves Hugo, it was a bloodbath. I'm just going to skip right to the end. It's Hurley and Libby, 75.8% of the vote. Screw everything
else. Is this the biggest win of all time?
It's pretty big.
Almost 76?
Well.
Wow.
Screw Evil Saeed and Flock. Screw Alana and the Dynamite. It's Hurley and Libby, 76% of the vote. Not since Jin and Camping have we seen a victory.
Have we seen something so big? All right, the Charlie Pace Memorial Final Words Award, the Them of Shaky Accents, goes to May I Cease My Identification. That's from Nadia, who isn't dead that we know of, but it will be the last time we see her on the series, so.
Fun fact, she's been in every single season, as well as the actress who plays Hurley's mom, and they're the only two, like, guest stars who've been in every single
season. Ooh!
Oh, that is a fun fact.
And I think we've seen the last of Hurley's mom as well. So farewell to those two wonderful actresses who have done such great.
Well, we'll keep Hurley's mom alive for our podcast intro through the rest of the goddamn series. God bless you. You did the Lord's work.
Carmen, right? Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Carmen.
The Frank Lapidus, Guess We're Not Going to Guam Act-Break Award is Locke, who says, well, here we go after smashing that radio that represented any sort of bargaining or peace between Widmore's camp and his camp. We're definitely getting closer to that war that they were alluding to a couple episodes back. And then the official podcast check-in doesn't exist. We only have like three official podcasts left for the entirety of the series.
Wow.
One of those will be like a post-finale thing, which I don't think we're necessarily going to use.
Should we watch like the Kimmel special and talk about that?
Maybe. Ooh. Okay, here's the thing.
That might be a fun thing to do.
The end The End is the name of the last episode of Lost. That podcast at this point is like, what, gonna be 6 hours? So, well, you know, we'll see how it goes. All right, that's gonna do it all for the calm this week. We're gonna meet you in the storm, should you want, right after this.
All right, now is the time on the podcast where we like to thank our Patreon subscribers at the $10 level or above. We're calling them candidates these days, but they've also been known as the Small Council in the past. Let's start with some newcomers. We've got Francesca Fox, Alex Rockridge, Kayla Hagman, Deschill is my stab at that name there, Nicholas Barclay, Catherine Lemarice, Natasha Napper, Scott Paolo, Jamie Taylor, Sarah Subzwari, Amy Kutzen, and Hizik. Guys, I'm really doing not well this week. Okay, Don Lotz, Nose Muffin, Carol Dietrich, Taylor Hughes, T. Ledieu, Savvy Nguyen, Eleanor Corkish, and Rachel Aluli. Thank you guys so much.
That made me want to look up that name. I think I would have said Doxzool, but like we've noticed, I'm bad at this and apparently have Ghostbusters on the mind. Here are my names, my candidates, to add to that thanks. I go with Leah Rock, Nicholas Ng, Elizabeth Hines, Nikki Jones, Brian Moon, Brett Gordon, Renee Kolb Nye, Liz Gonzalez, that's my mom, Ingvid Alda Bjork, Katie Lal, Cheryl Harris, Scott Wacholtz, Sarah Bausman, Marcus Mazziarelli, Samba Matuba, Greg Jagger. I almost just said Greg Jaeger. Why not? Greg Jagger, Lawrence Aggleton, Connor Mufish, Amy H, and Sean Duane. Thank you guys very much.
And I would like to thank the following fine humans: Debbie Denice, Nathan, Randy Elaine, Jen, Rich Lyman, Moira Burke, Raimi Quiton, Emma Mathis, Laura E, Dharma Jess, Ali Medeiros, Rachel Matusik, Jeff Cooper, Alicia Gressla, Monica Rickman, Alyssa Scott, Kwangyu Liu, Jewel Bailey, Liz Major, and Brian Morawski. Thank you all for being members of the Small Council or candidates, however it is you like to be identified.
And we're back for the storm. Yeah. Pew,
pew.
Yeah.
Pew, 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 pew.
Yeah. All right. Where do we want to start this week? Now that the smoke monster and the ghosts are in the calm where they belong.
We never see Richard in the sideways, right?
It's because he's not dead. Right? Right? Or well, did he die with people that were more important to him?
Well, that's a question. I was like, what do you think Richard's bardo is? Like, he starts to gray when they're taking off in the plane.
Mm-hmm.
So,
I mean, we know the answer, which is the Lost sequel series we've got Nestor Carbonell interested in.
Yes. Lost
now,
sequel
now it's just, you know,
it's just Richard's bardo.
A couple more years of covering Damon Lindelof content, and then we could give you the envelope you slip him under the table, and we'll bypass Disney and get the rights to Lost.
I just think that's interesting. And then do you think the reason we don't see Hurley is because he is... what's the music cue, Dave?
Oh!
Wake me up inside! Wake me up inside!
Yeah, is that why we don't see Hurley this week?
Yeah. Hurley's the first one who's still alive? Who's been... Oh, no, I guess Desmond.
They're all dead.
At least on the island.
Yeah. Desmond. Though I kind of think he died briefly in the solenoid microwave.
Is Desmond alive? Is he dead? It's hard to say.
Well, I think he does remember what's happening, though, which is something Neil asked, maybe facetiously in the calm, because right before he goes down to pull out the cork, he's like, hey, Jack, none of this matters. Like, I've seen it. Like, none of it matters.
I've been to the afterlife, brother.
Yeah, but then he pulls the cork and he's like, no! No! So who knows what... What I actually had.
Desmond and Jack, two peas in a pod, can never make up their minds.
Yeah, figure it out. Stop being such plot devices. Cool. What Juliet hints did you pick up there, Joanna? Because I thought it was very smooth.
Oh, I didn't even mean about her being the mom.
Oh.
I just mean, like, let's all remind ourselves, like, about Juliet.
Oh, that Juliet exists.
And that she's coming. Because, like, the thing that's... This is part two of my Sawyer rumination, which is, like, he's not running toward... Like, we don't know anything about what Sawyer's life is after he gets off the island, right? We can imagine certain things. Like, we know what Hurley does. We know what Ben does. We know that Kate and Claire hopefully, like, co-parent Aaron or something like that. Blah, blah. But what does Sawyer do? Like, I always kind of imagine that he is a dad to Clementine and is part of this, like, parenting collective with, like, Kate and Claire and Cassidy. But we don't know what he does at all. And the thing that he's running to is, like, his afterlife where he gets to see Juliet again, right? That's the happy ending for Sawyer. Mm-hmm. And that's a bummer. Like... You know what I mean? There's nothing. They're not giving him something to like live for.
Yeah.
Off island,
well, it's, you know? It's similar in some ways to the bummer of like Libby being in the church with Hurley at the end, right?
Exactly.
Like,
exactly.
Hurley goes off to live what we assume is a pretty fruitful life as the island protector, but Libby was still the only like the most significant person in his entire life. Mm. So sad stuff. Although you know, I mean, I like this idea that he just goes and he and Cassidy and Kate and Claire sort of live the commune life, I guess.
Yeah.
And raise these little island babies.
Island babies. Like, and I think that's why I really think they should be talking about Clem. And there's opportunity, you know what I mean? Like when Sawyer says to Kate, like, you don't want that around Aaron or whatever, right? Is something that he says to Kate. Like, Kate could have been like, what the fuck do you know about being a parent? Mm-hmm. Like, you've got a daughter. Like, all, you know, there's just opportunities.
One of us has met your kid.
Slide into the old Clementine reference in there sometimes. So, just saying. That's what I would have done. But yeah, Juliet, I mean, you know, like, Jack apologizing for Juliet. And then Sawyer, when Jin and Son smooch, Sawyer does give a little look to Claire, but mostly it's just a sad look to camera of like, I miss my girlfriend. And so I just think it's to like prime audiences to be excited for him when Juliet shows up at the vending machine.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
that's what I think.
Well, at least they're building
the vending machine works super well.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. That's amazing. Like, you don't, you forget that Sawyer has a kind of pretty bad arc the entire season because he gets that vending machine moment. You know what I mean? Like, when we think back about Sawyer in the final season, you think vending machine, and that's it. You don't think...
But that's because that's all they had for him to build to.
Sitting in Locke's camp, and then, you know, whatever else he does. So
he played the Search and Destroy, I know, because he's the forgotten boy. I know that for sure. And then he threw a ring off the dock. Something. Vending machine.
And then he was captain of the Elizabeth.
Captain of the Elizabeth.
30 minutes.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know. I'm trying to find to put a positive spin on this, but you're right. We focus on one good moment. Like, why couldn't they, if they know how to build something like that, why did nothing with Sun and Jin over the entirety of the series, which we're about to see the end of their arc, why was that not being able to build to? What makes that different?
I mean, exactly. And, like, that's the real bitch of all of this, is that, like, for those of us who are rewatching, of course, this sudden Jin moment feels bad. Because then Jin says that shit where he's like, we'll never be apart again. And you're like, no, not like this.
Yeah, right.
Not like this.
Well, technically, that's true.
I know. And it's bad, because Jin not leaving her is bad.
Right.
So it's just like... Not only does it not work, I think, for first-time watchers, based on the recaps I read, but, like, it feels really bad on a rewatch, so, yeah.
What else did you learn from those recaps?
Oh, I learned that everyone thought that Hurley was done leading. They were like, well, Hurley spent all his leadership chips getting them to camp, and now he's ready to not lead anymore, and I was like, you dummies.
You sons of bitches.
I mean, I didn't mean to. Was I hitting the gas too hard on that in the calm about Hurley and like leadership stuff? I don't know. Maybe.
No, and I think this is one of the things that is so well done about season six that it just works at the end. It came as such a wonderful surprise watching it, you know, back in the day live. That ultimately it was Hurley, and I think even if you know it's coming, we're in for just such a wonderfully emotional moment.
Yeah, you know, I think this is also building to like the idea that Hurley's leadership time is over. Like they want you to have that feeling because when you get to Jacob around the fire saying it has to be one of you, you want the audience to be saying it's Jack, just as Jack's saying it's Jack. You know?
Yeah, and I think I really like thinking about it goes back to like, I don't know, was that like season two? Whenever it was that like Hurley was working his like Sawyer campaign on the beach, remember? Mm-hmm. Like how we've been thinking all along about these leadership qualities that were inherent in Hurley, that he was leading from behind almost, you know? And so I like these moments we see where it becomes evident that like he is just such a worthy heir for Jacob. And I think this moment here, I think someone wrote into us about this when I was talking about how this idea of black and two players, one black, one white, is so anathema to what the show seems to be about. And someone wrote in like, that seems, they think that's the point and that the new era will be a less binary era. And that's exactly what Hurley's modeling here, right? We're not going to just leave Claire and Saeed in the black column and just leave them there. Mm-hmm. That's not how I view humanity. And that's the campaign promise from Hurley for Island God. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. I think it's interesting.
They should have listened to Hurley a long time ago, I guess.
Yeah.
Is the answer.
Why does Smokey save Jack? To gain his trust, I'm going to guess? Just, like, being a sneaky dude?
Yeah.
Well, like, does he feel like he still needs him as a player on the board to get the other people? You know, because, like, his ultimate goal is they all die, right?
Yeah.
So why doesn't he just let Jack die there? And then, you know?
Jack's got the island touch, so, like, he can't die there. And Smokey can't kill him.
Does Smokey still believe... Right. Okay. So this is where we start to unpack Smokey's plan. Because his whole plan was like, I'm going to take all these people to Hydra Island and then kill them and then get on the plane and leave. Right? Or does he need them all to, or can we believe at least the part where he needs them all to be able to leave?
He can't leave until they're all dead.
Okay. Right.
So he needs them all so that he can leave.
Mm-hmm. But does he need to kill them all at the same time?
No.
Is it
that seems
to
like
do,
some dumb island rule shit.
Is it easier to do on Hydra because it's farther away from the thing that's protecting?
Nothing I have learned so far in this show makes me believe that that's the case, but sure.
I mean, if we further away from the actual quark?
Well,
just quark adjacent.
I mean, he can't, even though the Hydra island's still in like the bubble, he can't smoke monster across the water, you know?
Right.
So it's like there's something about like that distance that it's like Widmore set up there probably for a reason, you know, the fact that he has to get everybody there is probably for a reason.
And, you know, maybe he knows that the island is still protecting Jack in some way, you know, like similar to the way the island wouldn't let Richard kill himself.
Yeah.
And
or let so Locke kill Richard. Or
Sawyer.
Yeah. So in his decision is... Well, Jack's not going to die from this anyway. I might as well use it to my advantage to try and continue to manipulate Jack. You know, because Jack is ultimately a threat to him.
Yeah. And he's got little baby Jacob running around making sure he doesn't kill anybody. Every time he's like, oh, he could just kill this dude, little baby Jacob shows up.
It's young Jacob and young Jacob's hairstylist out in the jungle protecting Jack.
So in terms of getting people to kill other people because he wants to be inactive in this, he's already blatantly murdered everybody he's just going to murder. Do we think the Saeed turn works when he doesn't kill Desmond? I mean, I made a lot of complaints about it in the column because, like, somebody should have stopped. Somebody should have just asked this question of Saeed really early on. But instead, we get Desmond, who has maybe some insight into what it's like to actually come back from the dead. How do we feel about Saeed's switcheroo?
I mean, it feels like this is the first time anyone's had anyone other than Flock has had a significant conversation with Saeed, right?
Well, except Kate was like trying to talk to him. That did not go well for Kate.
Don't feel anything.
Right.
I was like, oh, who would I have had talk to him instead? Who has a connection with him? And then I was remembering that, like, in season one, like, Kate and Saeed had some stuff going on, and that was fun. And I was like, oh, maybe Kate. And I was like, oh, yeah, she tried that.
Or if you're going to lay some track, have Shannon step out of the Whisper Woods. Like, good Lord. Be like, your dick is cursed. Come back to me.
Oh my god.
Saeed would be
god.
Like, that's Shannon... not true. There's this woman who abducted me. She's still alive. They're like, no, she blew up on the beach. She mishandled some dynamite. You weren't there, but I just swear your dick is cursed.
Oh, you think Alana died from the old Saeed cursed dick? It's a delayed reaction because she didn't like
all of these
go
things
the
are just like the other dead women that slept with Saeed. That's I feel like that's a somewhat connection.
I don't think she finished the job. Anyway, I am here's why I'm not satisfied with it. Because I don't think we get a very satisfying ending for Saeed. There's nothing left because Saeed does his like sacrifice move in the sub that's coming up. And then he like has that like he gets woken up by like saving Shannon in an alley fight or whatever. That's it for Saeed. There's nothing left for him. And that just sucks. So no, I'm not satisfied. I think this should have been a bigger moment, but they keep it a mystery because they're trying to make us believe that maybe Desmond's dead. It's, you know, just annoying.
Is he out of the well?
He's definitely not in the well when Locke goes back to check.
Mm-hmm.
At some point, I think Locke goes back to check the well and Desmond isn't there.
But story-wise... he's in the well, as far as we know. Just keep him to the side until we need him to pull that cork.
I think he might be like propped up against a tree somewhere.
Nice. Yeah, it's very puzzling rewatching this series and knowing where it all goes. The places they decide to hold on story and the places they decide to push story forward.
Just put Desmond down a well for a couple episodes. Fine.
And like, why are we doing this? After we've already, like, Jin got kidnapped over to the Widmore Island so we could see Desmond, and then we could see Desmond back to the main island, and then Son goes over to the Widmore Island. It's like, fuck, guys.
Oh, no, I remember. He's still in the well, and that's right, Vincent discovers him, and then Rose and Bernard rescue him.
All
right,
so he's still in the well.
Yeah, doesn't still down the well. So he just left him
there.
So
he didn't
like,
even let him out of the well.
I'm not going to kill you, but I'm also not going to give you any food or water. I'm just going to leave you here.
You like being underground on the island. I know who you are. Away.
Well. Yeah. Ugh, I don't know. The other thing is like a common theory that I was seeing crop up around the old recaps was this idea that like the sideways universe, like, and I think it stems from some of that confusing stuff that Eloise Hawking was saying. But the idea that, like, whatever the sideways universe is, the characters in that universe are going to have to sacrifice it and wake themselves up in order to stop the smoke monster. That they are being kept here asleep so that the smoke monster can win.
Mm.
Mm.
And, like, if you think that that's what's going to happen, the stuff with, like, let's say David and Jack is very poignant, right? Because, like, Jack is going to have to sacrifice his stardust son in order to, like, wake up and stop the smoke monster. That's not what happens. Jack just kind of forgets about his son and wanders into a church. But
he still sacrifices his son.
He like remembers Kate and then wanders into the church knowing half of what's going on. It's really, yes, it's odd.
But I just thought that was interesting. That's a theory I definitely would have been on board with at the time, probably.
Well, it's like, we're still riding this red herring that there's any sort of interaction between the two stories where it's like, maybe that's not John Locke in there in the sideways. And it's just like, it's way too late to be happening here. Like, let Sun and Jin obey the laws of time and already be in the hospital, you know, by the time we join them again. It's just, I don't like it. It feels like a lie. That's what it is. It feels like a lie. Right.
Can I pop into this? We do like the finale, we should say, even though we're kind of sour on some things that are happening this final season. Can I pop into this email we got from Kyle?
Let's.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. One, rewatch complete. It's the antagonist's hidden motivations that make the On-Island so bad. One of the premises of the podcast is Lost had a controversial ending. How does it hold up on rewatch? When we started this podcast, my remembrance of watching Lost 10 years ago was that the last scene was not as bad as everyone thought. I was not obsessed with all the answers to the mysteries and thought the true nature of the sideways was brilliant, so I expected to rewatch season 6 and feel those same positive feelings. But actually, my reaction is to feel more negative than before. I feel the same good vibes about the sideways, but now feel really let down by the On-Island plot, which is a total mess. The On-Island plot feels as if it's written not with the aim of revealing events naturally and gradually to viewers, but with the intention to provoke and confuse the Geoff Johnsons of the world on a week-to-week basis as much as possible. The confusion occurs because the antagonist character's motives are hidden more than normal, in contrast to prior seasons, where characters' motives would be revealed through straightforward dialogue with other characters. And this season, the motives and plans of Dogen, Flock, Saeed, Charles, Sawyer, and Ben at various points go unsaid in order to create ambiguity to keep viewers constantly guessing at the expense of clear storytelling. I actually think the Charles example is ultimately one of the clumsiest instances of this dynamic in the season. By the end of the show, it seems the facts of Widmore's motivations were reasonably simple. He returns with Desmond to the island because although he wanted to kill the Man in Black by normal means, he was prepared to have Desmond uncork and destroy the island along with the Man in Black if nothing else worked. Man in Black gets his info and realizes he can actually use this plan to his advantage if he can escape the island before it is destroyed. Fair enough. Rather than revealing Widmore's plan and then the Man in Black's plan straightforwardly, Widmore withholds the information for many episodes, then whispers it to the Man in Black under a not believable form of duress. Why, if Widmore believes that a released Man in Black would destroy all of life, does he think there would be a penny exception? Then the episode ends on the Man in Black's intention to destroy the island. Big cliffhanger. But doesn't reveal how he could escape the island until well into the finale. The whole thing is incredibly confusing to watch and seemed designed to maximize the amount of paragraphs that Geoff Johnson would need to game out the possibilities of what might happen next week. I feel like this is a frustrating on-island pattern the whole season. The show wants to toy with viewers' feelings about Dogen, Saeed, Flock, Charles, and even Sawyer to create as much plot twist potential as possible. It's just a mess. I think even the frustrating Dogen content might have been made simply because having such an irritating character at odds with Flock made Flock seem much more sympathetic, so that we'd be thrown off the scent of his malevolence for 8 episodes. I think the show would have been better served having Locke and Charles the folks at odds for the whole season and make everything else much simpler. I feel like the pains the show takes to mislead viewers and recappers into thinking the sideways is a multiverse created by the incident provides enough ambiguity and misdirect for one season of television. I still love the sideways enough to enjoy season 6 overall, but I'm definitely looking forward to hearing everyone else's On-Island fanfic. Kyle. I agree. What do you guys think?
Cosine. Most annoying thing in television is where characters that should be telling each other things are not telling each other things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I think that's entirely fair to what they're trying to do here in season 6. I think they the show, and this is another parallel with the other show that we've been talking about, the Game of Thrones, I believe it's called, where there are elements of the show that start to feel like they are no longer a conversation between the people creating the show and the audience at large. It's more of a conversation between the people who are making the show and the criticisms that they are receiving. And we got a lot of that in the end with Game of Thrones. And I think, you know, Lost is a huge example of that, because it was one of those first shows. By the end of this, if we remember sort of where the world was at, the world of like social media, this is when 2010 was huge. You know, Facebook was huge. You know, blogs and message boards were becoming a big deal. Twitter had sort of just taken off like 2 years earlier. So the amount of feedback, like direct feedback that they were able to get from the audience, from critics, from, you know, random dudes who created, you know, blogs, you know, in the mid 2000s and became sort of people that were read and became sort of a different breed of critic. You know, I think it's clear to me that the Lost creative team got caught up in that to a certain extent. And I think that there are some glaring issues in season six that show that. And, you know, it feels, you know, it's the most 2010 thing about Lost season six.
If I were to differ from that slightly, I would say that absolutely they're responding to criticism, but where I think Game of Thrones and Lost is going to diverge is Lost at least gets that sideways right. What it sort of feels like is they devised the sideways, they realized it worked, and then they had to construct an on-island thing knowing that none of it mattered. And so instead it's like this potpourri of answers they think that we want that are probably a lot of them responses, things, scenes where Jack just fucking straight out asks, "Are you my father?" But set it after a time period where Locke couldn't turn into his father because by lore, blah, 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 that sort of thing. It's the Iron Fleet, or Danny kind of forgot about the Iron Fleet. That's the entire island thing. They're moving these pieces around. Who gives a shit what we said before? Because they know it doesn't matter. I think I'm still giving negative points to Game of Thrones for knowing that all of that should matter. But at least Lost was able to chart out a course that was satisfying in some way in a season where they could have just been chasing the dragon and trying to answer everybody's questions.
They still get a lot of the character moments right.
Yeah.
And a lot of it is the strength of the writing in these individual scenes that work. You know, we've been talking a lot this week about the Claire and Kate scene, which as its own little scene works so wonderfully. It's well written. It's well acted. It fits with, you know, six seasons of character development that they've been doing for these two characters. You know, but then everything around it's kind of clunky. You know, how we get to it is clunky. What happens after it is clunky. And,
yeah.
You know.
And something I've heard the creators talk about, and I forget where, but they have talked about that this idea of trying to outsmart your viewer. It's something that we talk about, I think, mostly in Westworld season two is a time I remember thinking about it a lot, or Mr. Robot season two, I think. This idea of once you've tasted the sweet, sweet delight of having created a mystery that everyone fell for, in Westworld season one or Mr. Robot season one, or, you know, flash forwards, I would say, in Lost, then they're kind of on to you, but you still want to surprise them. So you get all tied up in knots trying to outsmart them. And I think our emailer's point about just withholding everything and making everything really murky, so there's no way someone could guess what was going on, just winds up making really bad television, I think. So. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
There's a lot to love in this final season of Lost, and a lot we do love. But I think, the more you watch it, the more the on-island stuff just feels
I think it's still going to be better than Game of Thrones, though, because Sawyer doesn't suddenly decide to kill everybody.
1,000%. So much better.
Now that we're on the Ajira flight, I'm Sawyer! This is owed to me.
Kyle also wrote another long email about Sun and Jin and how, you know, this might feel premature. I'm just worried I won't remember to read it when Sun and Jin go down with that ship next week. But his point was you couldn't leave Jin alive because then he's a player on the board who has way too much personal investment in killing Locke. And they wanted the showdown to be between Jack and Locke. So you can't leave Jin alive. I mean, he's not defending it. he's like, this was a shit move and they shouldn't have done it. But if you leave, if Jin leaves the Sun in the sub and swims to the surface in order to be with his daughter, who I guess in my head canon is also raised on the commune with Cassidy and Sawyer and Claire and Kate, is Jin's just too, he's got too, and we're too emotionally invested, right?
Sure.
We're mad. So
I don't think I would have had a problem with that, though. Like, no, if the end of Smokey was, like, he pissed off Jin.
Yeah,
that would be great.
And that's how he dies, and not some, like, cosmic fight on top of a rock with Jack.
But it's Jack punching and Kate shooting, and maybe, like, Jin could have killed him. Like, maybe it could have been, like, Murder on the Orient Express, and, like, Kate shoots him, and then Jin just stabs him a bunch just to make sure he's down. I don't know. I would have been fine with it.
You could give him the Captain America Civil War thing, where it's, like, Jin and Jack just, like, punching the shit out of Locke.
Oh, tossing the shield back and forth. Yeah. Ashley also wrote in an email titled Sun and Jin Alternate Ending. Hello, Joanna, David, Neil. I just want to write in and offer up the alternate ending my husband and I have concocted for Sun and Jin in the years since the finale. The whole let's keep them apart for the whole season thing is annoying, but they would have been able to get away with it if only they had changed up what happened on the sub. When Sun realizes she's stuck and tells Jin to go, he says he's not leaving her. This would have been a great moment for Sun to basically tell him, it's okay, I'm not leaving you. Not really. I'll be with you and Ji-Yun always. I'm sure they would have come up with something more eloquent and beautiful, but this is the story we would have preferred. I understand, I guess, that to have them both in the church in the end required them to die on the island because when the most important moments of their life had been with their daughter instead of with island people, but I still think Jin choosing to drown was a dumb choice. Stay loose and upright, Ashley. P.S. I was almost 19 when Lost premiered. Not 11, just in case you're keeping track.
All right.
P.P.S.
Yeah. That's
can't wait to hear you guys discuss the ending and specifically the conversation in the church between Jack and the dry ghost of Christian Shepherd. My tears flow fast and Lou said, hey, kiddo. And that talk is my go-to clip each time I need a good cry. Me too, Ashley. I just cue that clip up sometimes. And when he goes, I die too, I cry. Anyway, so that, you know, I just want to counteract our criticism with some finale positivity.
I want to loop back. Mm-hmm. That's why it's not Christian Shepherd's actual ghost, because Christian Shepherd moves on.
He doesn't move on yet.
Well, but like, Michael's not in the church because Michael's trapped on the island.
Yeah. I don't know.
Also, it's really depressing.
There is no yet.
It's also really depressing if your church conclusion is like, all the people had crushes on each other and then their children. I think would it be very depressing, no matter how realistic that would be in terms of people you want to spend your reality with. It's like, no one wants to be like, go into the lost church and you see like five grandmas you've never seen and 16 dogs and like, you know, all that stuff.
That's why the Bardo works in theory, and it's such a smart, interesting thing, and they decided they wanted to like do their version of what the afterlife is, and I love this version of the afterlife. I love it. I would love to like get on a plane and I got off and I'll like bump into you and to Neil somewhere at a doctor's appointment, the lawyer's office, whatever. And then we all go to a church together and move on. That's like, that's lovely. But like, you know, are your people there? It doesn't work unless it is like every Bardo is tailored to the person.
Right.
Do you know
Maybe
what I
they
mean?
Walk yeah. out of the church into a more traditional, you could be with everybody
or
situation.
Here's another one. Maybe that's what the afterlife is just living through different versions of the Bardo. So like every time you move on, you just move on to a different one.
And
where it's like, this
done.
Is the one with my family. This is the one with the girl I had a crush on in high school.
Yeah. And you think you're done and suddenly you're like, oh, Sarah from work, I'm in your Bardo. I didn't know it was that important to you.
It's okay. Infinite Bardos.
Bardos all the way down.
It makes me so tired. So
I'm so like, Dave, I'm so happy you have a sound cue, and I'm really mad that you haven't had one before.
Just one. It could have only been in the storm up until now, or up until last week when Hurley woke up, I think.
All right, I think we did it. What do you guys think?
Mm-hmm.
We did. We got through the last recruit. There's only like four episodes left, so
and one of them's real wild.
There's only four episodes left. We still haven't seen the origin of Jacob and the Man in Black yet, but don't worry, they can sneak that in right at the end. Neil,
mm-hmm.
Speaking of very sad times on the submarine, where are we going next week?
Oh well, you know, next week we're definitely going to have some not-so-fun times with Sun and Jin, and I think Saeed, right? Saeed doesn't quite make it out of this one.
Oh, no, yeah, he runs with that bomb and right out of the series.
Yeah, but, you know, it's from what I remember, some pretty good Flash Sideways stuff and lots of Jack and Locke and surgery and waking up, which is very important.
It is. Bet you thought I was going to do it, but no.
I did. I thought it.
It's like a seasoning, just a little bit. Yeah. Just a little bit for our out. August of Lost. all right. Until next week when we start bringing the sad, where can people find more of your work around the internet? Let's talk this week to Joanna Robinson first.
Oh, you can find me on vanityfair.com. You can follow me on Twitter at Joe Wrote This. All my other podcasts are on a little pause right now, which is nice for me. Well, Little Gold Men is existing, but I just get a couple weeks off from it. And yeah, don't fall down.
That's all. Yeah. And Mr. Neil Miller.
Well, you know, you can always get some of my work over at filmschoolrejects.com or on Twitter at Rejects or at One Perfect Shot. I do those. I thought there was one more exciting thing, but there really isn't. Just make sure that you are in our Patreon, patreon.com/stormspoilers. Do these last four live watches with us. They're going to be wild and quite a lot of fun.
And I'm Dave Gonzalez. You can follow me on Twitter at DA7E, but why? I'm not doing anything. You can listen to me on the Fighting in the War Room podcast, where I am talking about things. We had like a summer of horror this week, where I made Katie Rich watch one Fear Street movie. That's all she made it through, but we try to explain the rest to her. Maybe that's the type of podcast you like listening
Wait,
to.
Wait, which one? 1666? No,
she watched 1993.
Oh, okay.
So she's like, oh, I like the needle drops. And I'm like, oh, nah. Anyway. We end up liking Fear Street overall because, like, every group of teenagers should have dumb horror that is for them. And we finally got out of, like, sex shaming and stuff. So, like, please move forward, horror. We like more Fear Street. Anyway.
Haven't we been out of that for a little while? Like, they follow and stuff like that.
Oh, yeah, there's definitely elevated horror, but don't think anybody would describe Fear Street from Netflix as elevated horror.
Okay, better dumb horror.
Gotcha. Yeah. Every generation should have I Know What They Did, What You Did Last Summer. I just think that's part of the Lifetime experience. But this time, you don't need to objectify Jennifer, what's her face?
Jennifer Love Hewitt?
Thank you.
Yeah, there we go.
I'm sorry to forget a Party of Five cast member on this Lost podcast, but that's what happens right at the end, where I also remind you, don't fall down, and as we've learned this week, don't get wrapped up in white dudes' posthumous bullshit. It just seems like it's all bad news. We'll be seeing you next week.